When it comes to Atlantis hunting, there's no question that Graham Hancock's Fingerprints of the Gods is a seminal work in the modern day. It legitimized lost civilization theories in a way that hasn't been done in recent times. You could say it stripped a layer of tinfoil off the heads of Atlantis hunters in the public's eye. As controversial as it is influential, finding a fair evaluation of the book is almost impossible, and finding one on YouTube is impossible. I would like to change that, so here's the first video on what will hopefully be a lengthy series, in which I will look into the claims and fingerprints of the gods and determine how realistic they are and what evidence may support or undermine these claims. Hi, I'm Dan, and welcome to Dedunking. Now, Hancock starts with ancient maps and so shall we, and by the end of this video we will have covered almost a dozen of them, including the P.B. Rees and Arontius Phineas maps, of course, but also the Zeno map, the Mercator map, the Bausch map, and several others. So let's begin our review of Fingerprint of the Gods, Part 1, Chapters 1 through 3, Mystery of the Maps. Now, Hancock opens the book with a bombshell. 8th Reconnaissance Technical Squadron, Strategic Air Command, United States Air Force, Westover Air Force Base, Massachusetts. July 6, 1960. Subject, Admiral Peary Mee's World Map. To Professor Charles H. Hapgood, King College, Keene, New Hampshire. Dear Professor Hapgood, your request for evaluation of certain unusual features of the Peary Rees World Map of 1513 by this organization has been reviewed. The claim that the lower part of the map portrays the Princess Martha coast of Queen Maud Land, Antarctica, and the Palmer Peninsula is reasonable. We find this is the most logical and in all probability the correct interpretation of the map. The geographical detail shown in the lower part of the map agrees very remarkably with the results of the seismic profile made across the top of the ice cap by the Swedish-British Antarctic Expedition of 1949. This indicates the coastline had been mapped before it was covered by an ice cap. The ice cap in this region is now about a mile thick. We have no idea how the data on this map can be reconciled with the supposed state of geographical knowledge in 1513. Harold Z. Olmeyer, Lieutenant Colonel, United States Air Force, Commander.
Now, as many of you are aware, this has been opposed by almost everyone in academia. Colonel Olmeyer has basically just been dismissed. Despite him openly acknowledging the gravity of the words in his letter, the assumption that he either got it wrong, got tricked by Hapgood, the man the letter was written to begin with, or my personal favorite.
The U.S. Air Force SAC cartographers, for example, worked with him for 2 years and fully endorsed his conclusions about Antarctica. Ah yes, because there is no one I trust more than the U.S. government.
So I want to spend a quick moment discussing this Colonel Olmeyer and his career. I think it will show you he's someone who knew a thing or two about cartography. The earliest records I can find of his career describe him as a bombardier for the 455th United States Air Force Bomber Group in World War II, the Vulgar Vultures. He wasn't just a bombardier, he was the lead bombardier, the one that was tasked with finding the target. Even as a lieutenant, he had that job. And that job, you know, in the 1940s, there was no GPS, there's no satellites, there's no night vision, there's no thermals, there's nothing but mechanical sights and human senses. Now, when a bombing run began, after the pilot got them to the target, he would switch control to the bombardier. He would use the sight and have total control over the aircraft to line it up over the target. And this obviously is not easy at high altitudes, and it becomes really difficult when you imagine, you know, being under fire and like fighters coming at you and bullets flying through the hull of the airplane that you're in. That might make it a little bit more difficult. But to further complicate things, the common tactics of the day were smoke screens, blackouts, fake coastlines, fake cities, basically anything you could think of to trick that lead bombardier. Because here's the thing, the lead bombardier, he bombed a silhouette. Almost everything was done at night. So he's bombing a silhouette. He's bombing a line. His job is to actually hit a target. Everybody else just bombs that fireball that he made. So that lead bombardier's job is critical. And from what I can tell by doing research, Colonel Olmeyer held that from the time he started to the time that he ended his career in World War II as a bombardier. That was somewhere around 200 missions. Now, when he responded to Hapgood's letter, he was commander of the 8th Reconnaissance Technical Squadron of Strategic Air Command. Now, SAC controlled bombers, aerial refueling, aerial defenses in general during the Cold War. That was their job. His unit was a photography unit, tasked with making maps for strategic purposes by manually photographing them and assembling them. He had many trained cartographers under his command, and when he retired, he was a special assistant to the director for satellite programs of the Space and Missile Systems Organization, blah, blah, blah. Good Lord, what a long name. Point is, this man knew maps, and he worked with them for decades as a leading military officer in that field. Dismissing his opinion on the matter may well be dismissing one of the most informed people to have ever weighed in on it. This guy didn't just learn maps in college, which he did, he was an officer, but he also executed knowing them under heavy fire. So when he says the Peary Rees map shows a portion of Antarctica, Queen Maud Land specifically, with no ice on the coast? I am inclined to think he has a good reason for saying so. But there is annotations on the map, and they do tell a different story.
This country is a waste. Everything is in ruin, and it is said that large snakes are found here. For this reason, the Portuguese infidels did not land on these shores, and these are also said to be very hot.
And of course, geologists are clear. Antarctica has been covered by ice for millions of years, right? Well, not exactly. There's a ton of debate about the East Antarctic ice sheet and exactly when and where it covered what. But many models agree that the Queen Maud Land would have had ice-free coasts from somewhere around 10,000 to 6,000 years ago. Now, that's a much more realistic time frame for humans to have mapped that area than, say, 20 million years ago or whatever you have to go back to for find Antarctica with ice-free coasts. To find Antarctica ice-free altogether, excuse me. But then why would Piri Reis claim that it was all hot and full of snakes and all that? Well, perhaps he conflated the two areas with each other. He was working with multiple source maps. Perhaps he got Antarctica and parts of South America mixed up together. This is a common issue with older maps, and indeed it's frequently an argument employed to debunk these kinds of claims. In this case, it seems a very likely possibility, as explains both the accuracy of Queen Maud Land and the annotations that Piri Reis left. Now, of course, Hancock's going to explain to us how this may have came to be. He uses Earth crust displacement theory as his mechanism for Antarctica to have been mapped. It was once in a temperate zone. Basically, according to this book, Earth crust displacement theory claims that the Earth is like an orange, detached from the peel, but still inside of it. The peel is representing the crust, and that the orange itself represents the core. So as the two spin around, eventually the surface slips over the orange, right? The peel slips over the orange, and this represents the crust slipping over the core of the Earth, and this causes Antarctica to once be on the pole and to just jump to a temperate zone, or vice versa. This is proposed a manner in which the Earth shifted over time, allowing Antarctica to be moved in relatively recent times. Now, Earth crust displacement theory has been discarded. In fact, it's been rejected for about 40 years when Hancock first wrote Fingerprints. But it was endorsed by Einstein for a time, and as such, apparently seemed robust enough for Hancock to run with it. Now, Hancock no longer believes Earth crust displacement theory is likely, and as such, many of his positions have shifted since Fingerprints was written. However, we are reviewing Fingerprints, so while I will point out when Hancock no longer accepts something that he wrote in the book back in those days, I will still evaluate the claim. Earth crust displacement theory? Bad claim. Hancock himself accepts that now. Antarctica has been more or less where it is for a very long time, millions of years according to all the accepted science. Chapter 2 brings us to the Arrontius Phineus map, another map made before Antarctica was discovered in modern times that supposedly depicts it. Like the Piri Reis map, it is a product of several source maps, many unknown, which is where the possibility of ancient map makers leaving a fingerprint or two comes up. Also, like the Piri Reis map, it has several features that are used by Hancock to provide evidence for there being parts of real maps of Antarctica. Here, Hancock claims not only Queen Maud Land is well depicted, but Enderbury Land, Wilkes Land, Victoria Land, and Mary Bird Land have portions of their coast depicted of ice-free with extreme accuracy for the day. Surprisingly enough, all these areas may well have had times with ice-free coasts in relatively recent history. Queen Maud Land was already mentioned, but Enderbury Land has a mountainous coast and is under the same East Antarctic ice sheet that is so hotly debated, and the same can be said for Wilkes Land. Victoria Land and Mary Bird Land have parts of the coast that are ice-free enough that you can map them accurately today. There's a phenomenon known as Antarctic oases that are basically just a warm area in Antarctica that is often free of ice. These areas commonly form on the coast, then disappear after a time. Now, the Ross Sea is a little different. Hancock claims the rivers depicted flowing into it on the Arrontius Phineus map are indicative of rivers flowing into the sea in relatively recent times. Now, this may have happened for a short period of time when some glaciers fell into the ocean, but there's really not much evidence for it. Now, the best evidence I'm aware of are the cores that Hancock's mentioned in the book that supposedly contained river silt, but that silt has since been attributed to ocean current deposits, not rivers. Now, some climate models do say that those glaciers would break up and fall into the sea from time to time, so while the mapping of the coastline may have been possible, rivers flowing into the sea for any length of time is unlikely, even in the best of scenarios. In an article for the New York Times in 1984, during an interview with Dr. John Weihaupt, he was claiming that the Arrontius Phineus map and some others do portray Antarctica with ice-free coasts in places, but he wasn't willing to go back further than the Bronze Age for those discoveries. For years, a few imaginative authors have argued, based on 16th century maps, that the ice-covered continent of Antarctica was discovered and mapped by an ancient civilization, perhaps one from another planet. The latter proposition was dismissed by most geographers and historians as preposterous. Nevertheless, a careful comparison of information appearing on the maps with what is now known of the continent has led a leading geologist and polar specialist to propose that the outlines of Antarctica may in fact have been known long before Columbus reached America. The suggestion that it may have been discovered many centuries earlier has been made by Dr. John W. Weihaupt, Vice Chancellor for the Academic Affairs at University of Colorado at Denver. His analysis appears at the lead article on the August 28th issue of EOS, the Proceedings of the American Geophysical Union. Dr. Weihaupt, a specialist in seismic and gravity studies and planetary geology, conducted research at a number of Antarctic stations beginning with the International Geophysical Year of 1957-58. Interviewed by telephone recently, Dr. Weihaupt was reluctant to speculate on how the rough outline of Antarctica may have become known to early mapmakers, saying he was not a maritime historian. He suggested, however, that Bronze Age seafarers from the Mediterranean trading along the coast and west coast of Africa may have ventured further south than previously believed. A peaking period of warming. From 2600 to 9000 years ago, he said, the world was warmer than any time in the last million years, except for the period between the last two ice ages. Polar ice was presumably reduced, making high latitudes more tempting to explore.
So to be clear, experts who are not Atlantis hunters have found this compelling. Now back to Fingerprints of the Gods. Hancock next highlights the Mercator map, Atlas of 1569, which drew heavily from the Orontius Finius and other maps. It's claimed the coastlines of Antarctica are more accurate in this map. Honestly, I can't tell. I'm not a cartographer, and I was unable to find a comparison from actual experts. It is safe to say it drew heavily from the Orontius Finius map, as Mercator said as much in the annotations. Now next we move to Bach's map of the South Pole in 1737. Hancock claims this channel between the two land masses is evidence the map was made a long time ago when Antarctica was ice-free, not just partially ice-free coasts. This claim is the least viable of the map claims made in Chapter 2, is my opinion. Not only did the majority of the source maps come from the 18th century, but Bach himself speaks of mapping icebergs and the like in the annotations. It is most likely a map of what they could reach and guesswork filling in some blanks. It doesn't show the proper archipelago Antarctica would have been if it was ice-free either. Instead, it shows two large land masses where many small ones should be. So when Hancock tries to weave a timeline with these maps, making Bosch's first and then Orontius Finius, followed by Mercator and Peary Reese, it really doesn't hold up to scrutiny. Now we know that Orontius Finius heavily inspired Mercator's map, and that Bosch's map was almost certainly based on the newest rather than the oldest sources. Now of course Hancock here is trying to make a case for the Earth crust displacement theory I spoke of earlier, so he really may not think this anymore. He may not think there was ever a time in human history that Antarctica was completely ice-free. I'm not really sure. We then return to the Peary Reese map, as Hancock wants to highlight several details he believes show a knowledge of South America beyond what was supposedly known at the time. He speaks of two Amazon rivers being portrayed and the Andes being shown despite not yet being known. There's two Amazons because mistakes get made in old maps, especially when using multiple source maps like we've discussed earlier. These do actually look fairly compelling, including the island of Marajó at the mouth of the river. Maharo, I'm sorry, I'm not good at pronunciations for those of you who haven't watched me before. He also claims that two estuaries, I believe these two, are an earlier version of the Orinoco River, eventually growing in size over the ages. Personally, I find this a lot less compelling than the Amazons, quite a reach to be honest. Hancock says that these are the Falkland Islands, and I have to agree that that's a pretty strong resemblance. He claims that the rocks of St. Peter and St. Paul are portrayed by these here larger islands, and maybe the islands are pretty much in the right spot. That much is true. At the end of it, a lot of his points here do line up. Overall, these maps and others I will mention shortly seem to show things they should not, according to the mainstream view of history. So what are the arguments against these? Now, usually they're based on discrepancies, such as the extreme difference in size and orientation on the Orontius Finius map, or they'll attribute it to chance, finding other areas that match the coastlines of Brazil or Australia or the like in order to place the map in a different context and disregard the anomalous bits. Now, the first of these is understandable, but it's also used both ways. For example, this island here, Hancock nowadays claims is Bimini, but the mainstream consensus is this island is Cuba mingled with Japan, so its size, shape, and orientation have changed on the map. Could this not have happened with the coasts of Antarctica and Australia? Of course it could have, very easily. Now the second one is really only reasonable when there's only a handful of similarities. As the number increases, so does the likelihood there is something to the ancient mapmaker hypothesis. Again, we see conflation between areas in ancient maps all the time. It's a problem they face when using multiple sources.
So to find one landmass with two or three different coastlines that match up isn't crazy, but if we do see a coastline that matches Antarctica with ice-free coasts, it makes sense that that was potentially mapped during a time when it had ice-free coasts. They were ice-free relatively recently. We don't have to go back millions of years. Now, the next maps Hancock showcases are some of the weakest, in my opinion. The 1559 map of Haji Ahmed is purported to show a land bridge between Siberia and Alaska. I can't make out any real detail on this thing, even on the best images I can find of it. Nexty cites Ptolemy's map of the north, and I can't find anything by that name, but I did find his map of Scandinavia, which shows Sweden, which is the part he talks about. But Hancock says it depicts glaciers in the southern part of Sweden, and I'm not seeing it, so I don't know. The Portolano of Ayuidi Ibn Benzadar is next, and here Hancock claims it depicts glaciers far further south and shows oceans in the region that they might have looked like at the time. I suppose it's possible, but this too seems like quite a stretch to me. Now, I understand the desire to fill up content and to make it bigger and to have more supporting evidence and to make it look like the position you want to portray is so ubiquitous that only a fool would deny it. But in my opinion, dredging up a substandard evidence like this when you're trying to make a case for something extraordinary only serves to make your case look weaker. It shows you're willing to use evidence that's not up to snuff, and that makes more robust evidence brought out easier to dismiss without close analysis. These three maps are not ones I would cite as evidence for ancient map makers without a place knowledge, especially when Hancock hasn't discussed longitude yet. That's much better evidence. Now, longitude is much more difficult to accurately measure than latitude. Longitude requires accurate clocks that lose only a few seconds over months, which makes finding accurate longitude in ancient maps noteworthy. And he mentioned several cases here. Not only does the Piri Reis map have areas of accurate longitude over long distances, such as the distance between Africa and Brazil, but other maps have better longitude than we should expect. The Dulcet Portolano has accurate longitude throughout a good portion of the chart, which is odd for a Portolano. The Zeno map of 1380 is especially noteworthy because not only does it demonstrate extremely accurate longitude, but it shows that humans had the ability to, over time, map extremely cold areas that are frequently ice-covered coasts and make accurate maps of that area. The previously mentioned Orontius Phineus map has good longitude in parts of Antarctica itself. The aforementioned Portolano of Ayuidi Ibn Benzadar has extremely good longitude across the map. And from what I can tell, this isn't disputed. Academics just dismiss it as chance or claim that it's the product of exceptionally skilled cartographers. Now, Hancock mentions one more map before moving on, the stone pillar in China from 1137, known as UG2, I think, which also is said to be accurate outside of its place and time. Now, I can't help but to appreciate the tight grid shown used to demarcate the map. It obviously came from someone extremely skillful. Finally, we have a couple quotes from other experts. Professor Richard Strachan from MIT said the collection of maps Hapgood sent him, which included all the aforementioned maps and many others, overall seemed to utilize a Mercator-type projection before one was supposed to have existed. Now, it is worth pointing out that Professor Strachan was in the metallurgy department and not cartography. However, the next expert was part of the aforementioned 8th Air Force reconnaissance team, and Hancock quotes him as saying, "This," said Burroughs, "suggests the use of advanced mathematics. Further, the shape given to the Antarctic continent suggests the possibility, if not the probability, that the original source maps were compiled on a stereographic or mnemonic type of projection involving the use of spherical trigonometry. We are convinced that the findings made by you and your associates are valid and that they raise extremely important questions affecting geology and ancient history." But that's just an excerpt from Fingerprints. I think it's important we read the entire quote. "Dear Professor Hapgood, it is not very often that we have an opportunity to evaluate maps of ancient origin. The Piri Reis, 1513, and Orontius Phineus, 1531, maps sent to us by you presented a delightful challenge, for it was not readily conceivable that they could be so accurate without being forged. With added enthusiasm, we have accepted this challenge and have expended many off-duty hours evaluating your manuscript and the above maps. I am sure you'll be pleased to know we have concluded that both of these maps were compiled from accurate original source maps, irrespective of dates. Following is a brief summary of our findings. The solution of the Portolano projection used by Admiral Piri Reis, developed by your class in anthropology, must be very nearly correct. For when known geographical locations are checked in relationship with the grid computed by Mr. Richard W. Strachan, MIT, there is a remarkably close agreement. Piri Reis's use of the Portolano projection, centered on seeing Egypt, was an excellent choice, for it is a developable surface that would permit the relative size and shape of the Earth, and at that latitude, to be retained. It is our opinion that those who compiled the original map had an excellent knowledge of the continents covered by this map. As stated by Colonel Harold Z. Olmeyer in his letter to you, the Princess Martha coast of Queen Maud Land, Antarctica, appears to be truly represented in the southern sector of the Peary Reese map. The agreement of the Peary Reese map with the seismic profile of this area made by the Norwegian-British-Swedish expedition of 1949, supported by your solution of the grid, places beyond a reasonable doubt the conclusion that the original source maps must have been made before the present Antarctic ice cap covered the Queen Maud Land coasts. It is our opinion that the accuracy of the cartographic features shown in the Orontius Finius map suggests beyond a doubt that it was also compiled from accurate source maps of Antarctica, but in this case the entire continent. Close examination has proved the original source maps must have been compiled at a time when the landmass and inland waterways of the continent were relatively free of ice. This conclusion is further supported by a comparison of the Orontius Finius map with the results obtained by the International Geophysical Year teams and their measurement of the subglacial topography. The comparison also suggests that the original source maps, compiled in remote antiquity, were prepared when Antarctica was presumably free of ice. The cordiform projection used by Orontius Finius suggests the use of advanced mathematics. Further, the shape given to the Antarctic continent suggests the possibility, if not the probability, that the original source maps were compiled on a stereographic or mnemonic type of projection, involving the use of spherical trigonometry. We are convinced that the findings made by you and your associates are valid, and that they raise extremely important questions affecting geology and ancient history, questions which certainly require further investigation. We thank you for extending us the opportunity to have participated in the study of these maps. The following officers and airmen volunteered their time to assist Captain Lorenzo W. Burrows in this evaluation.
Captain Burrows seemed to have no trouble saying this was evidence of the mapping of an ice-free Antarctica, interior included. Now, Captain Burrows had no combat experience that I can find record of, but he was an African-American officer in the United States Air Force in the early 1960s, a position not held by many African-Americans at all in those days. Risking that position on crackpot ideas hardly seems reasonable or realistic. He most likely had to work his ass off to get it to begin with. Colonel Olmeyer and many other men worked on these maps together and determined the results as a body, as a military team. At the time of the writing of the letter, the official United States Air Force position on the Peary Reese map and friends, where they were most likely truly maps depicting Antarctica from ages ago. Now, many have dismissed these claims, and many of the claims associated with these maps are outlandish, but the possibility of an ancient people mapping portions of Antarctica's coastline when it was devoid of ice is not only geologically reasonable, but it seems to be supported by cartographic evidence. In order to claim otherwise, I would have to cherry-pick my expert opinions. As it is, it seems the cartographers who have taken the time to study these maps have a strong opinion about them being valid, and people not familiar with maps in general but to dislike the implications of these maps being valid are the ones that take issue with them. That's the end of part one. Thank you very much for taking the time and watching this far. If you want to see more of these, click the buttons down below and let me know if I did something wrong or if you did something right or I need one of those Manscaped things on my beard. Thank you very much and we'll see you next time.